The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU School of Business. Programs are also made possible in part by a grant from the Idaho Humanities Council, the state-based affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. Forum series sponsors are AARP Idaho, Bank of Idaho, Echelon Group, Micron, and St. Luke's Health System. The moderator for today's forum is Catherine Himes.
Welcome to today's City Club Forum on Swimming the Boise River, Source to Snake. I'm Dr. Catherine Himes, director of the McClure Center for Public Policy Research at the University of Idaho. I'm a City Club Forum Committee member and chair and moderator of today's forum. I would like to welcome our radio listeners to today's forum, joining us over Boise State University Public Radio on KBSX 91.5 and its affiliates throughout southern Idaho and northern Nevada. Today's forum is available for our audience in large part because of our City Club sponsors and partners. I would like to take time to thank a few of these organizations that help us achieve our mission to ensure compelling conversations, engage citizens, and a dynamic community. Thank you to our media partners, which include Boise State University Public Radio, 670 KBOI, the Idaho Statesman, Idaho Public Television, and Peppershock, and our university partners, the University of Idaho, Boise State University, and Northwest Nazarene University. Thank you again to today's forum sponsor, Midas Gold. Following Mr. Swain's opening presentation today, there will be an opportunity for you to respond to audience questions. There are question cards at each of the tables. If you have a question, then please fill out one of the cards and hold it up for a volunteer to collect during the presentation and deliver to the forum moderator. The moderator will do her best to present each question and may group similar inquiries together in the essence of time. Today's forum, Swimming the Boise River, Source to Snake, features renowned swimmer and water quality advocate, Christopher Swain. This summer, Idaho Business for the Outdoors is presenting Boise River, Source to Snake, an educational water journey created to bring communities together to support fishable, swimmable, and drinkable waters in Idaho. Mr. Swain is swimming the Boise River from its source, high in the Sawtooth Mountains, all the way to its confluence with the Snake River in Parma. At the time of this lunch, Mr. Swain is about halfway through his swim. This forum is the third in the four-part City Club of Boise, Idaho Environmental Forum Water Series. I am delighted to introduce Christopher Swain. He has swum over 3,000 miles in more than two dozen North American waterways in support of clean water and universal human rights. Mr. Swain was the first person in history to swim the entire lengths of the Columbia, Charles, Hudson, Mohawk, Mystic, and East Rivers, as well as Lake Champlain, the Gowanus Canal, Newton Creek, Long Island Sound, Narragansett Bay, and large sections of the Atlantic coast of the United States. During his swims, Mr. Swain has survived collisions with boats, 12-foot waves, lightning storms, class 4 plus rapids, waterfalls, log jams, toxic blue-green algae, blood-sucking lamprey eels, oil spills, raw sewage discharge, shark habitat, and water laced with arsenic, cyanide, dioxin, radioactive waste, polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, and neurotoxic pesticides. Mr. Swain documents his swims in photographs, videos, and journals. He interviews stakeholders and collects and shares location, personal physiology, and water quality data. Mr. Swain shares stories from his swims at events, conferences, and schools, as well as on social media. He is based in New York City and is the proud father of two teenage daughters, Mr. Swain, we look forward to your opening remarks.
Thank you. When I hear all that, I'm worried for that guy. Like, I want to say, are you okay? And another part of me wants to say, what is wrong with you? But I guess here we are. I think one way to approach you getting to know me a little bit is to just give you my sense of how I came to be sitting here in Boise. And I'm reminded of my sister Amanda, who I once asked, well, I never know, man, how to introduce myself and explain what I do and why I do it. And she just looked at me and she's like, bro, it's going to take a team of shrinks to figure out why you do what you do. You're never going to have the answer to that. So just don't try. Just be like, I'm a swimmer, and just try to push through, you know, get past that. So this is me right now going to try to push through for you. So when I was little, I was born in New York City. Don't hold that against me. I grew up in Massachusetts. Don't hold that against me. I was a kid. I did live in Oregon for 5 years. Maybe you can just think about that. I grew up in Massachusetts, and in the summer, the cheap, easy thing to do with your kids is just go to the whatever public beach, right? And so I was often at the beach with my grandparents. And I was the kid at the end of the day who never wanted to get out of the water. So I'm sure you've all been at the beach or the river, the lake at the end of the day, and there's some kid who won't get out, and their parents or their care providers are trying to get them out, right? And so, of course, now it's like, Susie, we talked about this, you know? I feel really uncomfortable because we said when I say it's time to go, you need to go, and you're just not getting out. And I feel like, you know, we're having like a reliability problem here. And I'm like, wow, that's in contrast to what I experienced in the 1970s was like, you'd get your blank out of the water right now. I already asked you. And that's followed by like, or I'll kick you into the middle of next week, which would be funny if parents yelled that stuff now, right? Can you imagine? Like everyone on their phones, 911, video. So after swerving into my childhood there, I think I'll get back on the track. So I never wanted to get out of the water. I was a kid who loved the water, but I didn't know about pollution. I didn't know about things. I mean, the most you could say about me as a kid, I probably knew about trash, right? And the trash we were worried about then was like, you know, stepping on glass or a pop top from a can. It wasn't like plastic and, you know, neurotoxic industrial waste that persists in the environment and builds up in your body and gives you cancer. That's not what everyone was worried about. It was just like, don't step on the broken bottle. You know, that's why you weren't supposed to throw your trash. So I was free of all that. And I have these great sunlit memories of swimming in the ocean with my sisters and like looking down and seeing like the sun dappling the sand. And you know, I had the cheap mask and snorkel and that didn't really work, that, you know, that you get for Christmas and that leaks. But I was constantly like swimming back and forth trying to find treasure because my grandparents, who were smart, right? They were like, yeah, get out there and look, because maybe if you look hard, there's like the edge of a chest, you'll be poking out of the sand down there. And if you keep swimming, you might find it'd be sad if you missed that treasure chest. So, of course, this fooled me for years, right? Like, that's a child care scam. You're trying to tire me out. I don't know. So never found the chest. But I really liked being in the water. I was one of those kids who didn't know what I wanted to do. I mean, I always answered, you know, like, yeah, I want to be a fireman or whatever. But I didn't have any vision of what I wanted to do. And all sorts of things interested me. After college, I ended up going to work for the university, just raising money for financial aid so other kids could go. But I, again, didn't have a particular thing. It wasn't until my late 20s that I had a swimming experience that shifted me. I had just done, in 1995, I had walked across the state of Massachusetts in the summer, giving out copies of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And it was because I was all fired up and I was in my 20s and I read this and I was like, wow, everyone should see this. I'm going to give this to everyone. So I got 10,000 copies of it and I walked across. Of course, there were some problems with this. Like, it's really hot in the summer and I was holding a flaming torch, so I was even hotter. and sweating all over my declarations. And yeah, and the road is melting. And that was the first time I saw the mirages, like when you look way down a road and it looks like there's a lake. And you think, oh, wow, I'm going to get to a lake in the middle of the road. How convenient is that? I'm totally overheating. And then you think, oh. So anyway, during that period of time, I thought to myself jokingly, it's too bad that I'm walking on a hot road. Maybe I should have done a swim because then I wouldn't be overheating like this. And literally, it's that stupid how I got into swimming. So that year, I went to the YMCA in the winter, and I was like, how can I learn to swim better? I mean, I had to swim. And they're like, what, learn the strokes better? And I said, yeah. They're like, yeah, do master swimming. They'll teach anybody, even you. So I did. And I learned, and then the next year, I decided, all right, I'll swim the lower Connecticut River. I'll swim 200 miles through Vermont, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and I'll give out this declaration that way, and ha-ha, I won't overheat. Well, ha-ha, swimming is not a good way to carry and give out pieces of paper, right? But I did have two experiences that stuck with me. One, people were nice enough to, and especially in the media, to let me say my thing about human rights. They were like, okay, fine, you're doing something for human rights. Say your 10 seconds about human rights. But what they really wanted to talk to me about was, did I know what I was swimming through? What was it like to swim through sewage? What was it like to swim through these cities? Like, do you know what's in there? So I realized, okay, what they really want to talk about is what's in the water. That's what they want to talk about. The second thing I learned is that I kind of enjoyed swimming. Like, I didn't mind swimming for a really long time. It seemed like other people minded it, though. Like, the main comment I got was, well, you swim for 6 hours a day? How can you do? Like, it seemed to everyone that I was superhuman. And I wasn't, but I seemed to like it. Like, I felt good in that place. So flash forward to 1997. I'm in Oregon in the Columbia River Gorge. I was at Crown Point, where some of you have no doubt stood, at the little rest pullout area. And I looked over across the gorge, and I saw the Columbia River, and I thought, oh, my gosh, we've got nothing like that on the East Coast. That's incredible. And I think I fell in love with the Columbia River unexpectedly at first sight. Ended up moving to Oregon as part of that. And long story short, processing my affection for the Columbia River by deciding in the end to swim the entire length of the river. And the reason I did that was that the more involved I got in trying to do river conservation and river protection, the more people were like, you know what? That's so great that you're interested in the Columbia. You're not from Oregon, so butt out. And then when I would do it over in Washington, they're like, you live in Oregon. We're not going to listen to you about the river. Like, go home. And then same thing in Canada. Like, well, it's great, Christopher, but you're not Canadian. So I'm like, oh, great. So I'm not from Oregon. I remembered what it felt like to swim the Connecticut River, like what it felt like to have that relationship with the river. And that's what kind of got me down the trail of thinking maybe I should swim the whole thing, which is sort of a crazy idea in a way, right? So I'm going to swim 1,243 miles. I talked to people about this idea, and they were like, you know, people have swum 4,000-mile-long rivers, like really good athletes, you know, good swimmers. But nobody's ever done the Columbia. Don't you think there's a reason why? Like maybe, and what they were trying to say is, don't you think smarter people looked at this and walked away? Don't you think better athletes took a pass for a reason? And I'm sure they did. There were so many good reasons, like problem bears and rapids. And I've seen 110-foot fir trees caught in whirlpools in Redgrave Canyon. Like, there's so many good reasons not to swim the Columbia River. But somehow none of that seemed to stop me. So I did swim the entire length of the Columbia River. It took me 165 days. When I finished, I said, if there's anyone in this watershed, and that watershed includes Boise, right? Includes the Boise River. It's 260,000 square miles of Canada and the West here. I said, if there's anyone out there who can hear me who thinks I might be able to help them on a tributary or one of their waterways, get in touch with me. I'll try to help. I'm a deeply flawed human being with limited skills and not much common sense, according to some people. But I'll try to help. Flash forward to 2013, some kids at Timberline High School watched a documentary about my Columbia River swim. They invited me out. I went to Outside Day in Discovery Park in 2013, and some of the kids were like, would you ever swim the Boise River? And I said, yeah, maybe. I mean, if we can put it together, if we can do it in a way that would help, maybe do science all the way along, some of the stuff you guys are doing, connect it to the schools, yeah, sure. And I didn't think anything would come of that, but something did, and here I am. So as I sit here, I'm thinking in the introduction that you kindly read, and I still think that guy needs help that you read about. It said I was halfway done. So I was halfway done probably when we wrote the introduction for City Club. So I have about 200 yards to go before I'm in the Snake River. So I'm mostly done. Thank you. And despite the fact that in law enforcement-only secret Facebook groups, it was suggested to the New York Police Department that they, quote, find me and slap me around before that idiot comes to Idaho and kills himself, I did survive the swim and deepened my affection, I think, for the watershed, but also for the Boise and for Idaho. So I know I'm running out of time to make opening remarks, but I'll say one more quick thing. It was an abstract idea to me that Idaho had 9.2 million roadless acres of wilderness until I spent time in the wilderness. But you have more wilderness than every single U.S. state except for Alaska, right? And it was just a fun fact to me that you have 107,000 miles of rivers in Idaho, which is a lot. So as someone who's now put their body into your wilderness and into your rivers and risks myself, I can say those things feel very real to me. Another thing that feels real to me is I have this sense now of Idaho, and it's a thin slice, and of the people of Idaho. And I'll share it with you for what it's worth, because I know I'm coming from the outside, so it's fraught. I don't think you can separate the people of Idaho from the lands and waters. I think it's not just that you see yourselves as belonging to the land and the water. It's a part of your identity. It's part of who you are. Every single person that talks to me for more than a minute here finds out what I'm doing, testifies to the fact that they love this place. They love the land. They love the water. They want pristine wilderness. They want pure water. It's not a joke. It goes beyond politics, beyond income range, everything. Everybody's all about that. I think Idaho is something that you can't separate from the outdoors, from the land, and from the water. And to be an Idahoan, as I glimpse it, is to love those things and have those things baked into who you are. So part of the reason I came out here to swim is I think I had some sense of that from the kids that I met at Discovery Park in 2013. I had a sense that if I came out here and risked my health and safety, risked my life in the river, because there's a reason people don't just throw themselves into rivers and swim them, that it would mean something, that this was a ball that the people of Idaho could pick up and go with. Because let me tell you the little secret about environmental conservation. Oh my God, I said the E word. Oh no. Here's the secret. It's kindergarten stuff. It's so easy. There's only two things you need to do. One, protect whatever land and water you have that's pristine, that's not messed up yet. Protect it as soon as you can. Second thing, go clean up the mess wherever it's messed up. That's it. Don't clean up the mess first, because when you're done with the mess, there might not be any pristine wilderness left. So always protect the good stuff first, then go clean up the mess. Kindergartner could figure out what to do. So it's not that we don't know what to do. It's that it's hard. It's usually a hard road. It's hard work. And this is what gives me hope about Idaho, and some of you heard me say it before. Idahoans aren't afraid of hard work. You are only here. Yes. Applaud yourselves. I mean, I would say a similar thing in Oregon, right? You know, but here's the thing. you are who you are because of the challenges you've met. And this little state and her people have been through a lot. It's not nothing to live here and to have made a life here. And I get it. You don't want people coming in and messing it up. So welcome to Idaho. Go home. You know, we're full, all that. We did that in Oregon too. But I will say this. Some of the people who are going to come here are going to come here because of the outdoors. They're going to come here because they love the land and they love the water. And don't worry, most of them are just on vacation and they're going to go home. But they are your natural allies. They would be happy to help you protect these things. And you should be happy to take their money and let them recreate. Because why not? That's part of protecting Idaho. Because the thing I think you can do, and the reason I was willing to risk this for all of you, is I think you can have a swimmable, fishable, drinkable Boise someday. Because all it takes is hard work. And I think you can do it because it's baked into who you are. All of you love Idaho. And that means you love clean air. You love clean water. You love pristine wilderness. And you want to protect those things for future generations. So do the people who come here to use those things. And so do the people who voted differently than you. That's something that unites all of you. And let me tell you, in the culture right now, that's powerful. Any common ground. So thank you for listening to my opening statement. And I look forward to the questions.
Thank you so much. Before we turn to some of the questions from the audience, I would like to remind our radio listeners that you are listening to a City Club of Boise forum on Swimming the Boise River, Source to Snake, featuring Christopher Swain, long distance swimmer. So we've had a couple questions come in that relate to the Boise River in particular. So I'm going to combine two of them. So this will seem very long. How is the Boise River similar to or different from other bodies of water you've taken on? It's a relatively small river. What attracted you to this project? We heard a little bit of your connection with the students. But then here's another question that I think we would really be interested in your answer. What is the biggest issue you saw or experienced in the Boise River? Or what were the worst pollutants uncovered by water quality, etc.?
The Boise River is similar to a lot of rivers that I've swum and a lot of Western rivers in that it starts out as a pristine wilderness stream. And by the end, it shows the evidence of all of the choices the people in the watershed have made. So it starts out beautiful, glistening, mineral water that you can see for yards and yards and yards if you put your head underwater. And it finishes up as some kind of sediment-laden chocolate milk experience, which is very similar to lots of our rivers that flow through areas where there's human activity. So the short answer to what is the biggest problem, what's the biggest challenge facing the Boise River, we are the biggest problem and the biggest challenge facing the Boise River. So our sewage goes into the river. In order to do food production, to eat food we need, where it got to withdraw irrigation water and put it back. And when we put it back, it's got all kinds of things in it. Just those two things, if we stuck to them, are a lot. But there's more, right? We build cities and towns. And that means everything on the street. And think what you see on the street, on the sidewalk, right? Everything. All the trash, all the leaves, all the dirt, all the dog poop, all the gas and oil that's dripped off the cars, all the copper and asbestos brake dust from stepping on the brakes every time you get to a stop sign, that's all on the street. And every time it rains or every time the snow melts, that washes into the storm drains and into the nearest waterway. And here that means into the Boise River. So then you have what we would loosely call urban runoff, everything that's on the street that goes in and all the trash that goes with it. So you've got urban runoff, you've got agricultural runoff, you've got whatever various inputs there are from industry, and all those things together do it. But we're all benefiting from all those things. We want to live in cities. We want food to eat, right? We want livestock to for the different benefits that they offer us. We want different industrial applications. So we're all part of it. And I think for me, one of the big leaps is saying, like, I'm part of the problem. If I want to run around and drive a car and, you know, have street lights and you know, paved roads and be able to call for pizza at 2 o'clock in the morning, then that's going to mess up the environment a little bit, right? So I'd say that we are, and that if we're going to look at the problem of what to do, it's really important not to do the blame game. Like, this isn't somebody's fault. This is just where we ended up. One way to think about rivers is that they tell the story of progress in America. They reflect every choice we ever made. If you start digging around in the Boise, you'd be like, if you came later in history and you're saying, okay, I'm doing some sort of river archaeology, I want to see what these people were up to, you'd be like, oh, it looks like they did mining. It looks like they had a city. It looks like they did a lot of farming. It looks like they withdrew drinking water from here. It looks like there are some factories that threw some stuff in because there are some heavy metals and chemical residue. It looks like they were using pesticides and herbicides. It looks like they had internal combustion engines and all kinds of stuff. All that's in there. So rivers reflect all the choices that we've made as a people. That means we can make different choices as people and clean up our rivers. What I think doesn't help is blaming people or groups for the problem, because we're all part of the problem. The other thing I think it's important to say is, if you call out an area of an issue, if you say, well, I'm not returning irrigation water that's full of sediment, phosphates, and bacteria and overheated to the river, so let's go after the people who are doing that. Let's not go after the people doing that. What can we do to help the people who are doing that, to help them find a different way to do it, so they can keep growing our food? Thank you. Food is great, right? And return drinking water quality to the river. What's our duty to those folks? Their duty to us, right, is providing food. What can we do for them? So I think that spirit gets a lot further on all the rivers.
Thank you. In your opening, you mentioned the question, what's in the water, that people really want to know that. So I have two specific follow-ups to the general Boise River question. What was it like to swim through the working ag portion of the Boise River? I think they want details. And then the other question is, how did you manage low water and dams? What was that really like for you to move through the water?
So I have a complicated relationship with dams, which gives me an idea. Maybe I should go on social media and be like, say I'm in a relationship with dams, but it's complicated, because that would be fair. So here's the deal if you're a swimmer with the dams. On the one hand, dams are a drag, because if it were a clean, fast, free-flowing stream, whatever stream you're in, you could get this over with sooner, right? You'd get further in 6 hours. But sometimes dams create reservoirs where it's finally deep enough to take a lot of strokes, and sometimes that's fun too. Because I had days on the Boise River when I took less than 10 freestyle strokes because it was so shallow, and days on the Boise River when I took more than 10,000 strokes in that day because there was enough water to swim. So I walk around the dams when I get to them, and I try not to get too upset. And of course, we can go down the whole road with dams, but there are big reasons we build dams besides that they're fun and cool to dam builders, because I think that's a reason, but not the big reason. I mean, think, whoever built the Hoover Dam must have been like, you know, man, this is going to be cool. You know, someone thought that. I think we build them because we want to hold back water that we can use for different things, to generate power, for irrigation, or to prevent floods. Those are the sort of the big three. And that every dam and every reservoir and every river has different needs or whatever. But long story short, I move around those dams. So in terms of the agricultural portion, I started noticing irrigation return and stuff. I think by the time I got to Middleton, it was severe. So here's what you would notice as a swimmer. The water coming back in from the drains is hotter because it's been in the sun, right? And it's been like exposed to a lot of sun, and it hasn't been surrounded by other cold water. So it's hotter. Another thing you notice is things are going on that aren't normally going on when you're in the upper river. So there are cattle in the river, right? Relieving themselves sometimes in the river. Which you got to remember, if you're swimming by a bunch of cattle in the river, one way to think of it is like, oh, they're hot, so they're in the river, which is fair enough. But another way to think of it is they are all pooping in the river as I'm watching, and I'm swimming really near them. And that isn't a quality of life enhancing experience. In terms of the irrigation water, I can taste what I now recognize as agricultural chemicals, like that phosphates, nitrates, all that stuff. And I can taste the manure that's in, that would come back in from the fields. And I know that that has a high bacteria load. I know I can get sick. I get ear infection or an eye infection or a rash from doing that. Also, you can see that very often, because of floods or because cattle are big and strong, that the barbed wire fences are crashed out and they're actually in the river. So I came around the corner a couple times and almost hit partially submerged barbed wire fences, which is, again, not great for swimming. Probably not good for fish either. I'm not saying people do that on purpose. I'm just saying like that's something that happened that someone hadn't caught yet. The other thing is with the withdrawal of water, there's not as much water. So I'm in a situation where I don't have enough depth to swim sometimes. So I'm kicking off a tube. Like I'll hang my back legs off the tube and I'll kick because I'm banging into so many rocks, sometimes 100 rocks an hour. So if you combine that with the loss of visibility from all the sediment and the manure in the water, if I put my goggles in, if I think it's deep enough to swim and I put my head under with my goggles and I start to swim, I can't see sometimes more than a few inches. So I can't see if I'm about to bash into a fence, an old car, a log, a rock. So it's imagine if you swam, but you knew you were in shallow water, but you couldn't see anything. You the whole time would be bracing for like, oh my God, what am I going to hit now? And if your history was, I'm hitting something every minute, sometimes every few seconds, then you would be very gun shy. And that's what happened. So it became, at points, impossible to swim because there was no visibility and it was so shallow. So that was sad for me as a swimmer. I wanted more water in the stream and I wanted it to be clear enough to see. But I also think that the other side of it is like, what could I be doing to help? Like how I have an interest as a swimmer. How can I connect a farmer with resources that'll help them, I don't know, run their irrigation return through an activated wetland to clear some of the sediment out or help them do drip irrigation so they get stronger root systems in their crops. They don't have to use as much water because no farmer ever has enough water and not as much comes back. I mean, I have to think like I have some responsibility to them as well. But it was definitely a different experience. It felt, if I had to sum it up, it was like swimming through nasty chocolate milk by the end. Everyone silently vows never to drink chocolate milk again.
We did not have chocolate milk at lunch today. So this next question shifts gears a little bit. In your opening, you talked about Idahoans and that we have a lot in common regardless of where people are on a political spectrum. This question has to do with rural Idaho and urban Idaho because you really swam through both places as well as ex-urban areas and so forth. Could you just talk a little bit about when you met with people in those different areas? This question wants to know about values, how people viewed the river in those different places.
This is what you all have in common. Everyone loves the river. Everyone loves it. I mean, I guess if you stand back far enough and say like, you know, raise your hand if you're against clean water. Like some wiseacre is going to raise their hand, but really nobody is. This is the thing. Like even my family is like, oh my God, you're going to rural Idaho. You know, they're going to kill you. And I'm like, why? Why are they going to kill me? And they're like, well, you're from the east and you're in there about the environment. And I'm like, I don't think so. That's not my experience. And my sister's like, you showed me those screenshots NYPD gave you of all those Facebook posts from the Idaho cops who think you should be slapped around. And I'm like, here's the thing. It'll change when I survive the swim. It will. And it did. People are supportive. So here are the three things I noticed. Everyone likes clean water. They don't always say it, but I can tell they respect the fact that I put myself on the line. Everyone likes that I risked my life. Somehow I get a brief place at the table there. And I think also the thing I'm noticing is that most of the people out there, they're out there near the river because they're doing something they enjoy. They're often doing it with their loved ones. Or they're working. They're making a living in a way that connects to the water. Like farming would be a great example of that. These are all people who want to keep doing that stuff and share it with the people they love. And it's part of who they are and how they make a living and how they enjoy their life. So the big thing I noticed, the difference between rural Idahoans and Idahoans of the city, is they're using and enjoying the river differently. Like, I didn't see the farmers floating down on tubes, right? But I did see that in Boise. But the sentiments were the same. Everybody loves this river. They want it to be clean, and they want to share it with the people they love. So if anything, a reservoir of shared affection for the river. It was more what I saw that united.
I'm really glad to hear you say that. I think it's an important message in Idaho and in these times. These next two questions are, what can people do personally? So I'm going to read both of them because I think they're quite interesting. So there's someone in the audience who also grew up in Massachusetts. They're willing to admit this.
I dare you to stand up. All right. Where did you grow up? Leominster, my God.
I'm very glad you said Leominster. Because some of these words are a little tricky if you don't know the pronunciation trick. So she remembers her brother and she would look at the colors in Nashua River, and they were small children, and they didn't really know the horrific reasons why it looked that way. It has since been cleaned up. Is there a way that we can do this everywhere? And that's connected to this other question, which is, what is the most important change that I can make?
So for those of you who don't know the Nashua River, and this was, I didn't see the Nashua River when it was still like this, but before the Clean Water Act, the Nashua River actually changed color depending on the different things that were getting pumped in, the different dyes and chemicals. So she's saying she would go out there with her brother and they'd be like, okay, do you think it's going to be green today or red today or blue today? It was that bad. So the Nashua was a poster river for complete industrial nightmare. And it's now a clean, mostly free-flowing river. It's a great example of how community got together and turned something back into a jewel. Like, parts of the Nashua River now look like they would have looked pre-European contact. Small parts, but it's there. It's wild to see. Anyway, so getting back to this thing, what can you do? Raise your hand if you like being told what to do. And now raise your hand if you want to be told what to do by some guy from New York. I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'll tell you this. There's a lie in the environmental movement that everyone's been told. And here's the lie, that a big idea is going to save us. Big ideas aren't what move people. Strong feelings are what move people. And I always think I have to find a better example than this, but this sometimes resonates with certain audiences. There are people who've had extramarital affairs. Are they doing that because it's a good idea? Or are they doing that because they feel so strongly that they're going to go ahead and blow up their life? I think it's important to remember that motivation and emotion share a linguistic root. And that motivation isn't really lies in the terrain of the heart. You're going to do stuff if you feel strongly enough. And the emotions that are going to make you feel the most strongly, that you're going to go the furthest for, are clustered around love and affection. I would do anything for my kids, even if it were a bad idea, right? Because I love my kids. I would do it. I wouldn't even think about it. Of course I would protect my kids. It's what you do because you love them. So what I would say is, if you're looking for something to do, look into your heart and say, what's fun? What's rewarding? What could I do in the river that's fun for me? Because if you go have fun, rewarding experiences with the river, whatever those are, walking on the green belt, riding your bike along the paths, writing poetry, doing watercolor painting, tubing, floating, swimming, snorkeling, whitewater park, whatever, rafting, kayaking, whatever's fun for you. If you're out there having fun, you're going to have a rewarding experience. It's going to build your affection for the river, your respect for the river, your love for the river, if we dare use that word. You know, men talking about love can be this revolutionary area. So if you think about it, we protect the people and the places and the things that we love. So the best bet for the Boise River is that you all go do what you love to do with the Boise River. You go use and enjoy it in the ways that feel good to you. Because if you do that, it will deepen your relationship with the river. It will strengthen your bond with the river. And it will further the distance you're willing to go for that river. And when that happens, protection and restoration will take care of themselves.
We have some serious questions, but first I want to return to chocolate milk.
I'm going to get a chocolate milk sponsor for my next
No chocolate milk sponsor. People are interested in what you eat to sustain yourself, whether you're floating on the raft and kicking at the bottom of the river, on the riverbed. They're also interested in where you have been that had the best food in Idaho. So what do you do on a daily basis when you're swimming? Yeah. And your favorite food in Idaho?
Okay, gosh. So here's what I eat. It's kind of boring. The short answer is carbohydrate drink, and some of it's in powder form, and some of it's in gel form. I sometimes, on this swim we decided, my crew guy Andy and I, we were like, okay, should we do lunch on this swim? Like, should we bring conventional food? And he's like, I don't know. You always get bored. Maybe you should bring some conventional food. So sometimes I would have things. So the gel I'm using, what's the quickest way to say this is, the Breaking 2 project that some of you know about that Nike did, seeing if you could get Kipchoge and some of those other marathoners to run a marathon under 2 hours. To do that, they had to come up with a way to push 80 grams of carbohydrate into a runner an hour without them getting sick. So they found the sports scientists in Sweden that were able to make a hydrogel that could pass through your stomach and get into your lower intestine before it started to release the carbohydrate, potassium, all that. That means you don't get sick. So the big thing when you're swimming is what could you eat without feeling sick? So I'm using the Martin gel and the Martin carbohydrate powder. And then for our conventional lunch, I was eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches like I did on the Columbia, although I don't eat 10 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches a day like I did on the Columbia. Those days are gone. And I did have a 5 or 6 year hiatus from peanut butter sandwiches after the Columbia. But peanut butter and jelly, by the way, is a good thing. If you went and surveyed endurance athletes at the Olympic level, many of them would tell you that they still can fall back on peanut butter and jelly as one of their options. And sometimes I had turkey sandwich. So this is hard because I'm just now getting to where I could do the food tour in Boise. So I've had a few experiences, but they're all right near my homestay. And I did put on my fact sheet that IBO asked me to do that I love ice cream and grilled meat. So feel free to give me your recommendations. Oh gosh, I haven't really done much. Like, I really like the salads at Flatbread. And I've tried some of your local gelato and all that. I didn't go to the A&W yet, but I remembered when I was in Canada, whenever they had to catch a problem bear, they'd get the grease from A&W and put it out, and they would always catch the problem bear. They said it was like the one thing you needed to get all the bears in one place. So I guess I want to say on that, like, The best food I've had in Idaho so far are the berries that I've picked. So I've had raspberries and blackberries that were literal flavor bombs that overloaded my nervous system and my brain when I bit into them. And when I was in the Sawtooths and I saw piles of bear poop and acres of stripped huckleberries, I thought, you know, I really can't blame the bears. Like, they were left alone with millions of huckleberries. They have no self-control. They ate them all. That's what I would do. So far, my best food experiences connect to really basic stuff that's grown with Boise River water and sunlight. And I look forward to more of the restaurant things, but some of the things that you're growing here are mind-blowingly good.
Many people in the audience may not be familiar with the science that's happening along this swim. You know, there are some who are following you minute by minute on the app, But I thought it would be helpful if you could talk about the water quality sampling programs that are happening, and in particular, how those coordinate with any research that's taking place at universities or state and federal agencies.
One of the cool opportunities that was here for us on this expedition is that no one has ever done a full-length transect from the sawtooth to the snake of water quality science on the Boise. So if you were going to set policy on the Boise and you're like, I need water quality data from every single part of this river, that doesn't exist. Now it exists. And that is just a beginning, but it's a baseline. And that's something that Idaho Business for the Outdoors was like, this is something we can do. And we've made all that data, the parts of it that are analyzed so far, that's coming more every day, available on the app, and it will be available forever publicly for the agencies to use. So if you were trying to figure out, okay, where's the best bull trout habitat in the upper part of the Middle Fork or whatever that would be, or what's going on in Spangle Lake at the source of the river, we have the beginnings of those answers now. So now if you want to set policy, it can be based on the science. So I think the answer to your question is, in part, a lot of work's going to get done now. But one of the cool things about this expedition is that is begun, and that there'll be a science-based approach that can be taken. And I think that's important because the Boise River is a jewel and there's a lot there to protect. And when it's gone, right? The other thing I would say on the math science side is I've been thinking a lot about the economics of the Boise River lately. Not that I like to think about economics, and I'm definitely not an economist. And full disclosure, I didn't do well in econ, and I had my struggles in science in school. It wasn't always my fun thing. But I've done a lot of work with the United Nations in New York on different stuff around clean water since about 2004. And one of the things that I was thinking about when I was swimming in Idaho is 3 out of 4 jobs in the global workforce require clean water. So that's kind of wild. Like, if you took away clean water, you're taking away 75% of the jobs. We all know what happens if that happens, right? So that was one thing I was thinking about. The other thing I was thinking about was outdoor recreation, because Idaho has a massive amount of wilderness acres and rivers, right? So theoretically, you're an outdoor recreation paradise. So think about the numbers on that. $400 billion a year outdoor recreation represents in the U.S. as an economic input, as part of GDP, okay? Not to get all crazy. $400 billion. That's a lot of money, and that's a lot of jobs. Idaho would get a disproportionate amount of that because you have most of the wilderness. You have so many outdoor recreation opportunities. That means, we don't know because they don't have state-by-state numbers yet, billions and billions of dollars are coming to Idaho that are connected to outdoor rec and outdoor business. For comparison purposes, farming is $200 billion of GDP. So it's half of what outdoor recreation is. For comparison purposes, mining is $55 billion. So closer to an eighth of outdoor recreation. Interestingly, all three of these sectors would use the river, right? Most outdoor recreation in Idaho connects somehow to water. Mining, they use water. Farming, they use water. Outdoor rec is sustainable in that they don't do anything that harms the water. They do what they do and it goes on. Rafting doesn't have a net thing. So it made me think, just for a second, if we're getting into science and math, that one way to think about this is there are more jobs and more money in Idaho connected to your wilderness and the outdoor recreation opportunities than any of your traditional sectors. So I'm not saying abandon the farmers. Heck no. Help them farm in a way that protects the river. I'm not saying abandon the miners. Help them mine in a way that protects the land and the water. But I'm saying maybe we should look at this differently. Most of the money and most of the jobs is coming from outdoor rec. And that doesn't do anything to the environment. That just protects it. They have to. They can't do outdoor recreation if it's not all pristine. So that goes on and on and on. There's no danger anything gets harmed. So just for the heck of it, I thought I'd throw that into the space. That if we said we've got this much water and this much energy to expend, and everybody needs jobs and we all need money, where should we put the energy? It seems like one place to start putting energy would be the outdoor recreation part. Doesn't do any damage. It protects the land and water, and that's a lot of money and a lot of jobs. So that's been going through my mind, too.
Can I go back to citizen science?
Yes.
And would you mention how children have been involved in your work in the Boise River?
Sure. I think is it 16 different schools that are at the moment and going to be involved in doing citizen water sampling, give or take, 12 to 16 schools. So what we've done is we've identified basic water quality parameters like temperature and pH and turbidity, which is like water quality, the amount of dissolved oxygen, different things that would help give you a sense of the health of the waterway. And we've sampled those at all different locations all the way down the river. And then we've had some of that sampling activity done by trained college students, but some of it's being done by local high school students. And some of the high school students are going back and doing it again where their university colleagues have done it. And as you know, sampling the water in one place one time is something. Doing it again and again there, you start to develop a picture of what's going on. So the cool thing about, for me, about why the high school and middle school kids are involved is they're starting to develop and expand this treasure trove of knowledge that we're having about the Boise. And as long as that's done with the right quality assurance and quality control and that's made publicly available, then those kids are contributing to the body of science that all the policymakers will be able to use to make decisions about and hopefully protect the river. And by the way, remember what school was like? Would you rather be indoors or on a field trip? So all these kids I see who are doing water sampling, like I'm sure some of them are totally committed to water sampling. But I think a lot of them are like, we're out of the building. You know, it's not the worst thing to be like on the river for the day. Think what you could be doing. I mean, I say, when I think back on my school experience, even when there was an assembly, I didn't care what it was about. I'm like, yes, we're out of class. It's like, could be the hot air balloon guy. One guy came who repaired organs in churches. I mean, I was just glad to be out of class. So I think in some way, we're doing a service to the children we once were by getting them out of the building.
This member of the audience is interested in the measurable changes that have resulted from your awareness-raising swims. If you could give some examples.
This comes up a lot. So the thing I wish we could measure is the effect on kids of seeing someone risk their life to shine a light and try to energize a cleanup of some kind. And there's really no way to measure that. But I've been in front of over 80,000 school children in the last 20 plus years. And lots of them come up to me after and say that it helps them to hear that somebody's doing something. And lots of them say, you know what, grown-ups talk to me all day about what they can do. You're the only person I've met who's willing to risk your life and actually put your body in there and do anything about it. And I don't think they're dismissing the scientists at their computers and in the labs. But I think what they're saying is there's a lot of talk and there's not a lot of action. And one of the experiences you have as a kid is grown-ups talking at you. But you can't help wondering what they're actually risking, how much skin they have in the game. So I don't know how to measure that, but that's a real thing. The effect on a kid when adults willing to risk something because they care. So we can't measure that. What can we measure? When I swam the Gowanus Canal in New York City, which is arguably one of the most polluted waterways in the country, I swam that in 2015. So the surface is covered with rainbow sheen from coal tar residue. The mud has so much coal tar and flammable chemicals in it that if you took the mud out, you could light it on fire. There's also oil, gas, urban runoff, and raw sewage in the waterway. It's so dirty, the city of New York has cultured live gonorrhea in the canal. Right, can you imagine that conversation? You have gonorrhea? Yeah. But you're saying you got it from the canal? That's right. Get out! That didn't happen to me, but it did cross my mind. Be super, super awkward. I just like to swim. Come on, where are you going? Those swims generated over 1 billion media impressions just in the week that the two different weeks that you measured when I did a swim that year. And it energized a federal cleanup that's now going to result in the cleanup of that whole waterway. It's going to take decades. On Newtown Creek in New York, I complained about a lot of things. The largest ongoing oil spill in the United States that I had to swim through. Don't recommend swimming through oil spills. The sewage and trash that I swam through. The city told me that there was no money to do anything. Then there was a lot of media coverage for the swim. Here's a trick. If you do something on Christmas Eve or the day before Christmas Eve time, the only stories getting done are the last-minute shopping stories. So they're looking for one other story, right? And I was the one other story, swimming in sewage and oil spill in Newtown Creek through the trash. And I got some publicity for that. 30 days after that, the city of New York magically found $23 million to start cleaning up the trash in Newtown Creek. And there's more things like that, so I'll stop there.
I have one more question, which is, what's next?
What's next? On this project, what's next is, as I transition from the water to doing more of the events, like kids are back in school now, I think the trick is how to pass the torch to the kids. So my next challenge is to work with Idaho Business for the Outdoors and their partners to do three things. First thing is remind people that we did this expedition to start a conversation, and it's not a real conversation unless everybody gets heard, unless everyone has a place at the table. So that means we want to hear everybody's hopes and everybody's dreams for the Boise River. So when you hear me on Idaho Matters saying, you know, go on social media and share your hopes for the river and hashtag it Boise River Hopes, I'm serious. People are looking. Make your voice heard. When I tell the school groups, what are your hopes? You're going to inherit this river. Make your voice heard. So that's the first thing. Enlarge the conversation so everybody gets a place at the table. Since it turns out that everyone loves the river and loves clean water, let's find a way forward where we can protect the river and everybody can get what they need. That conversation is what comes next. And it's important to remind everybody as part of this, like the swim isn't just some one and done thing. Like, yeah, some guy came and he swam and that's it and he's gone. No, I was able to introduce the river to a larger audience by risking my life. But now you and you're part of that larger audience, you get to decide what you want to do with your river. That river belongs to you. It belongs to the people of Idaho. And people have no more right to pollute it than they have to come into your house and dump trash in your bathtub. It's that simple. You wouldn't tolerate that. The other thing I would say is, you're only here in Boise because of this river. The only reason the city is here is because of this river. Your drinking water, the water on your tables right now in those pitchers at this City Club luncheon, came from the Boise River aquifer. All of it. It's the only reason you can survive here. It's the only reason you can grow food here. So the next time you're thinking, I don't really want to pick up this dog poop. I'm not even sure I wanted a dog. The reason to pick up the dog poop, even someone else's, is that's going to run into your drinking water. The reason to pick up trash at Barber Park or Ann Morrison, that's some other idiot's trash that they didn't pick up, is because it's going to go in your drinking water. Your ability to survive and thrive here is hopelessly tied up with that river. But things aren't hopeless because you're the people of Idaho, right? There's no challenge you've stood down from. Don't stand down from this one. It's your drinking water. It's your life. It's your way of life, these rivers. And what I think's possible is that you all could be a national model. There's a way you could turn, embrace this river, stand up for what it means to your survival and to your way of life and to your identity that could be a model to this whole country of the way we ought to act toward our lands and waters. And I think that's what comes next. What comes next is the people of Boise and Idaho show the world what it means to take good care of your lands and your waters. And who better to do that than all of you?
On behalf of the City Club of Boise, please join me in thanking Mr. Christopher Swain for participating in today's forum.
You have been listening to the City Club of Boise, a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club forum is on Wednesday, the 18th of September, and will focus on the future of transportation in the Treasure Valley with a panel from the Southwest Idaho Chapter of Women in Transportation. Find more on that event and others at cityclubofboise.org. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.